Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Dr. Christina Tuis-Gradle, founder and managing director of Endeavour, which works with partners from all sectors to identify and implement innovative market-based solutions to poverty. With over 13 years of experience in research and advising on sustainability, strategy and development issues, including a stint as a strategy consultant at McKinsey and a PhD in inclusive business models, Christina is a thought leader, writer and regular speaker on inclusive business and related policies and ecosystems, and has contributed to more than 20 publications. Christina is a research fellow at the CSR Initiative of the Harvard Kennedy School, a strategic advisor to the UNDP Inclusive Market Initiative, and a former Kofi Annan Fellow on Global Governance. I spoke face-to-face with Christina in Delhi, India. So Christina, welcome to Change Hackers.
Hi.
Hi.
Pleased to be here.
So we're together for the BOP Summit in Delhi, which is what's turning into an annual event for bringing together people who really care about lifting poor out of poverty in the bottom 4 billion around the world. Let's talk a little bit about how you got started in your own journey to what you're doing now. You run an organization called Endeavour, based in Berlin, which has been going for a few years now.
Ten years.
So how did you get started on that? I mean, what was the spark that led you down that path?
I have to go back to probably the spark was in 2001 when I was living in New York and the Twin Towers came down and I was there. And after the September 11th, I was very inspired by how everybody was getting engaged in helping. The whole city was an action hub, you could say, trying to help each other.
Pulling together.
Yeah. That was the starting point where I felt without resources, you can actually do something really big. And that's when I started to think, how could I curate something like that? And when I got back to Germany, I was studying then to university, I set up an initiative to connect NGOs with volunteers. And that was the starting point. And we set up an internet platform. Internet was still very new back then. I think that was.
Come on, you're not that old.
Yeah, the internet had been around, but still, it was the early days.
Yeah.
So 18 years ago or 17 years ago. So we connected. We started with a hypothesis that, you know, there were many more people that wanted to help than have the opportunity to help now, and mobilizing them and bringing them, linking them up with the NGOs. That was our work. And from there, that got me into corporate volunteering. What's the role of corporates in that? And from there, I looked for something to do about leveraging the power of companies to save the world, basically. And that's when I read C.K. Prahlad's book, indeed. And so that was the link, I think, when I was back at university 2005, 2006, I was looking for the topic that I would want to dedicate my company to. So I already had this idea of setting up a consulting company. Mm-hmm. And that's when it clicked. And I thought, bring together innovation and poverty alleviation and corporate growth, basically. That's an exciting angle. Mm-hmm. So long story.
No, not at all. That's where the idea came from in the first place. How hard was it getting started? Getting your first client?
We were very lucky. It wasn't hard at all, I would say. Our platform, so I set it up with two co-founders initially. Later on, one of them left and we relaunched the company. And all of us were PhD students at the time. So after my first degree, I went on to join McKinsey & Company as a strategy consultant to learn the tools, to learn the ropes, basically, and went back to do a PhD. And that was, so we were funded in a way, and we could explore this topic of how to include poor people into value chains. And as part of the PhD, I got linked up with the UNDP as part of it was called the Kofi Annan Fellowship on Global Governance. So I could work with the UNDP at a time when they were getting into the topic. They had just set up the Growing Inclusive Markets Initiative, which brought together all the major players in the world that were working at the topic at the time to launch the concept of inclusive business. Before it was called Base of the Pyramid, the Base of the Pyramid is still used, but the business approach is now known as inclusive business, and UNDP invented it at the time, and I was lucky enough to become the lead author of that first report of UNDP. So it's serendipity.
That's a big leg up.
Yeah, I was just there at the right time somehow. And from there, we went on to work with UNDP. And then I went back to Germany and started to promote the concept in Germany. It does take a lot of patience still. It's not a concept that is widely understood or very thought after, if we're honest. But it wasn't hard in the sense that, you know, we didn't have anything to do and didn't have funding. We went step by step from one project to the next and built our market, so to say.
So that point you just made about the raising awareness how easy did you find it to understand where your audience was coming from? And you know, reframing the arguments in language that made sense to them?
Very hard.
Okay.
I think we're still grappling with that.
And right.
We have an ongoing conversation about that, about where do we really get people where it's relevant for them, where really they want to invest and not just to say, oh, interesting concept, but it's not for me, but where they see this is exactly where I should be at this point in time. So we keep re-evaluating that, and I'm not sure we've come to the end point of that. What we've started to do just last year, after another round of this reassessments of where's the audience and what is the leverage point, we really brought in the technology topic at the core of the conversation, because this is, I think, where everybody wants to be at this time and where everybody needs to be, because technology is changing how the world works. And this is what really brings the NGOs, the companies, policymakers all together to understand how can we together go through the systems change in a way that will end up in a benefit for all and not leave a lot of people behind. I think that's what makes a lot of people scared at the moment, that so many feel left behind and all the negative consequences that come from that. So in addition to innovation and inclusion, poverty alleviation, we added technology to the mix, and we see that makes sense, that really gets people very interested.
A lot of the things you're trying to address are systemic in nature.
Yes.
Individual corporate clients can't possibly tackle them on their own. To what extent are you working at building partnerships, you know, across different sectors involving corporate clients?
Mm-hmm.
You know, with governments, with NGOs, and with others, and then finding the right change agents within each of those organisations that can lean into what you're trying to do,
mm-hmm.
And be a bit entrepreneurial,
yeah.
Despite being in government. Or are those people easy to find?
So there's two sets of people. There are the change makers, as you would call them, inside the organisations that want to change, that want to drive change, but they are often not the people who have the mandate and the resources and the power to make the change.
Right, yeah.
So often, I'd say we have an extended community of friends that are convinced that you know, we need to be more inclusive in our ways, but often they don't have the leverage inside their own organizations to really move something ahead. Again, I think that's why we brought the technology topic to bear, because rather than speaking with CSR people or, I don't know, the people in government organizations that are already focusing outward, you're really usually at the heart of the organization, speaking with the people who are right in there and often have more power to make a change. And we see ourselves at Endeavor as what we call ecosystem facilitators. So we work with all these different parties and we look for where the transformative change has to happen and then try to bring all these different players together in the process. We came up with an initiative called Inclusive Innovation 2030 that tries to do just that. So we pick a topic where we think the time is ripe to take the leap, and we bring people together in a design thinking process to come up with a systemic innovation together.
Do you initiate that, or do you have a...
We do initiate that.
Right.
But as you can imagine, it's very, very hard to pull it off. So we've done it the first time last year. We had 5 tracks. One of them is the one that we continue tomorrow with the precision agriculture. The observation is, you know, we have a lot of new tech to make agriculture more efficient and effective, but it's only available to the very big farmers. But the small farmers who need it, because they don't have a lot of resources and their productivity is very low, so far they don't have access to a data-driven approach. Mm. So we are asking, how can we bring this data-driven approach to small farmers? And we had a very good workshop in Berlin in October, bringing together big guys like Bayer and John Deere with social entrepreneurs and with the NGOs that are working with the small farmers, and came up with this idea of... let's make it a platform approach. Let's link all these resources and make a big push. But now we're working to actually make it a reality. The commitment is there from all these players to be part of this initiative. But it's hard once people leave the room then to really make progress. And I think that's the big nut we still have to crack, especially without any core funding in place for us as facilitators to... It takes a lot of time to move people through such a process. So it's what we are grappling with at the moment.
So there's a shift there for your business model from what started out as consulting to being a catalyst. Now, what you might call
it. I think we were always a catalyst.
You were always a catalyst. Okay.
Because nobody wants these business models. We always have to push people into it.
Yeah. Okay. But you are now effectively an honest broker. And trust is a huge part of that. Building trust with all these different stakeholders, many of whom perhaps don't trust each other.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing the boundary spanning between them, which takes time. So does that mean that you have to focus in on a particular sector and really go deep on those relationships? Is it transferable? Have you learned anything about building trust quickly that enables you to hop from one sector to another to have impact?
Yeah, I always get a bit nervous when I hear trust. I'm an economist by training, so I still have this mental model of the rational human being, and I believe that when people have the right information and the right incentives, then you know that's what drives interaction and not necessarily some kind of history. So if they have evidence that somebody else is to be trusted, you don't need a long time to establish that trust. I trust a lot of people who I interact with in the market because I know there's regulation and there's systems so that they wouldn't cheat me. Right. I do that more so in Germany than in India. So here I'm a bit less trustful because of the system around. So
yeah.
I think that's how we facilitate by looking at the incentives everybody has and rational question marks everybody has about the intentions of the other people in the room, and trying to be very transparent about why everybody is in the room and why there's good reason to trust the other, because we're all here for the same purpose. There is an issue with language, because all these people speak a totally different language, even though they all might speak German or English. They don't easily communicate among each other because abstract concepts...
Yeah, and professional language they use, jargon. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So again, I think what's important is to find the topic that is relevant for all of them. Mm. Not talk at cloud 7 somewhere about some abstract goal of alleviating poverty and how could we do that. But like in the case of precision agriculture, this is something where everybody knows what is the concrete situation of small farmers. Everybody in this field knows what is the concrete situation of small farmers. Basically in any low-income country of the world, and how might technology change that? So you're talking about something very concrete, not abstract at all, and that's how you can get the misunderstanding out of the way, and that's how also you can get to productive cooperation and trust, if you wish, because it's not an ideological conversation, it's a very practical conversation. How can I, as the NGO working with smallholders, work with you as the input provider to get the inputs to my smallholders? That's, you know, a very practical question, and I don't need to know much about your intentions to trust you in that. I know you want to sell your inputs, so if that's what I want from you, then it's an easy relationship.
Yeah, so the mapping of individual, what people are trying to get done.
Basically. Exactly.
Yeah, an aligning of incentives around that, and it all falls into place fairly quickly. When you're looking at a systemic problem like that, you've said already that you're taking the risk on this.
Yes.
Is that perhaps because there's a difficulty in identifying one actor that has sufficient ownership of the problem to be
That's
a first
the
mover?
That's the problem, yes. Yeah. That is the inherent problem in all systemic change.
Yeah.
Again, in economic theory, we call that the problem of public goods. Everybody has an interest in some good to be created. Nobody has the interest to pay for that good. So there are some examples in systemic change where one individual player has enough of a return expectation to move it ahead. But I would say these are in the minority. Most of the time, it's really a coordination failure issue. And we try to play that role of the coordinator, but it's tough.
So can you give us an example of a success story, a very practical one that you've had by working with some stakeholders?
I don't know whether we are far enough yet. So this is quite a new agenda that we've taken on. Before, we've worked with individual players. We have done some work with UNDP on ecosystem facilitation in several countries, where at least what we see is a success of important players talking to each other and working on a solution. So, for example, in Uganda, we worked on the topic of ecological tourism or sustainable tourism, bringing together players from government, players from industry associations, companies, to talk about how could tourism in Uganda be more inclusive. And everybody there has a vital interest in that, including the companies, because there's a lot of population pressure, including on the protected areas, which are the main asset for tourism, where the gorillas and chimps and where everybody wants to go.
Yeah.
So people still go there and slash the forest. You need to, you know, make them benefit from that tourism, otherwise you're losing your tourism base. So this conversation is now happening, and they're looking for solutions and investing in new ideas of companies of how to be more inclusive. But we've not we're in the process. We haven't seen the result from that. But I would say it's a promising progress so far.
Mm-hmm. Would you regard yourself as entrepreneurial?
Yes.
Yes. Where does that come from?
That's a good question. I never thought about that. My parents are teachers. It can't come from
there.
My father, I think he would have been very happy if I had become a banker with a secure position. I can't tell you. I think that it was that spark that I talked about earlier, that first project that I set up, and just seeing that out of nothing, you can create something very...
And then by doing that, I guess that reinforces that spark.
Yeah.
And gives you more self-belief that you can go on and do something more ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
But started small. There was no grand ambition to begin with.
Well, I like to think big. I think that's part of the... I have difficulty looking at the small things.
Do you? Take a huge, great problem and try and figure out how to solve that one.
Exactly.
So, right from the start, though, you've been a part of a team. So you've had co-founders. Not something that you've wanted to do on your own. Probably almost impossible to do on your own.
I think that's part of the fun. On the way that you can actually pick the people you want to work with and like-minded people and
So the co-founders that you started out with, was that your kind of a rational selection of people based upon skill sets, or was it just you were friends as students and that's how it started?
Yeah, again, it was kind of chance in a way.
Yeah.
So I entered McKinsey with this idea to set up a sustainability consulting company of some sort. And so when I did, so in Germany, we do a, people do a 2-year program inside McKinsey, then they go out back to school again, come back. Mm-hmm. To me, I always saw it as a 2-year training program, go back to school and set up my company. And so when I got out, the first person I thought about to join me was a McKinsey colleague who also went to study development further. And then she joined me, and then I went back to my first university to, with the intention to dissolve this initiative that I told you about, this volunteering initiative, mm-hmm. Because we had all left and nobody could take care of it anymore. It turned out that somebody took it over in that university town, and I met the third co-founder, who is now my partner in Endeavor, who had just started her PhD on base of the pyramid topic. So, you know, it just happened in a way that we got together. Afterwards, I thought I should have probably been a bit more systematic about it, because I approached it like I approached this first initiative, inviting everybody to come on board. But it's a bit different in a business way. You're talking money, and you need to make money, and you need to distribute money, and that's not, that brings in other complications. So in the end, we couldn't stay together, and yeah, that was a big, painful rupture in the whole Endeavor story.
Yeah, but not unusual for people to.
No, it's quite normal. Yeah,
you know, part ways at some point.
And maybe there is no rational way to pick to your partner.
No, I don't think there is really. But less painful early on than it would have been much later on.
Yeah. Now, when I look back, of course, it's not such a big thing. But when you build something for 3 years and then you have to basically erase it, it hurts.
So, in building a team, how many is in the team now?
Now there's 10 full-time and like a closer circle of 30 associated experts, we call them.
Okay. How have you gone about building that team? I mean, what have you been looking for?
I think we've mainly looked for the passion. So we still invite people to join us who share our passion. Mm-hmm. We haven't been particularly rigorous on figuring out which skills exactly do we need. So everybody who's joined us in the core team has been working with us for a while, often a number of years, before we invite them, either we invite them to become a director, which is still a freelance position with responsibility to develop business, or give them a job, essentially, as project manager. Mm-hmm. So we know everybody who joins the company very well when they join the company.
Mm-hmm. So you've got a progression route through from, you do internships?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Typically through internships or through our, because on every project we work with freelancers.
Yes.
Basically from our core team, we only provide the quality assurance and project management, and everybody else comes from the outside. Since we work across sectors, across countries, we have to always bring people from the ground on board. Mm-hmm. And we like doing that because like that we meet more people like us.
Yeah. And just thinking of yourself in terms of your own development as you know, as a first-time entrepreneur, well, okay, there's been some chapters along the way, but essentially this is your first sort of
company.
serious venture with people that you're responsible for paying their wages and so on. What do you personally get stuck on now as a business owner and as a leader? Things that you struggle with, things that you feel that you're weak on.
No, oh, I'm perfect. You can cut that.
That can't possibly be true.
I just find it funny that I can't come up. No, there's a lot of things that I.
What I'll do
that
is
I'm learning all the time.
I'll edit out the long pause. Yeah.
I never feel like I'm stuck. I think there's always these moments where I get frustrated and I think, are we on the right track, or should we do something completely different? But that's always a productive phase. That's usually when, you know, the new thing comes along. So I was quite, I have a daughter of 17 months. So when I came back from maternity leave 1 year ago, I didn't feel like I want to manage, like have that role of managing the company and taking ever more of a organizational responsibility, telling people what to do and getting further away from the project work. I felt that it didn't motivate me to stay in this, I'm the leader of the organization role. Mm-hmm. And it made me think what should be my next step then. If I'm not doing it with passion, then probably I shouldn't be doing it at all. Mm-hmm. So I weighed the options. I could find a job. I could start something new. I could reorganize the company. And that's what we're doing now. So we are reorganizing the company to be a self-managed organization, holacracy.
Yes. Yeah.
And I love doing that. So that's why I know already when I feel like I'm getting stuck, it's probably a good moment that will get us ahead. That's why I don't ever really feel like I'm stuck. Maybe that's why it's hard to answer the question.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, looking forward, looking ahead, is there a particular goals in mind?
That's also a good question that I keep asking myself. I can't picture myself staying in Endeavor forever or, full time, just sticking with the company that I set up when I was 28 or so. To me, the self-management process is also a way to kind of maybe move to a more high-level role and open up space for new things. Yes. Mm-hmm. I would like to just explore doing different things, maybe write a bestseller.
Really? We're all multifaceted, I guess.
I'm studying how to write bestsellers at the moment because I think it's easier than to... I wouldn't be able to write a really good book, but I think
Is that a confession you prefer to edit out?
I'm also working on ventures where I'm basically building inclusive businesses in countries, and I would like to make some more time for that and figure out how this venture thing works, because I don't have a finance background, so there's again a learning trajectory and building a new setup for that kind of work that's completely different from consulting. So there's more things that I want to do.
Is that state?
There's no end point where I think I'm done with. That's where I want to get at, and then I'm done.
Does that early stage in a venture creation is that the bit that excites you the most? The kind of putting it all together.
I definitely breathing idea life phase into it. Of things.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm not so nitty gritty. I like when things fall, the conceptualization, things falling into place, making sense, getting them moving. Then I'm quite happy also to withdraw again.
What's the key things you've taken from this summit so far?
I find it very surprising how naturally people now talk about ecosystem as a concept for doing business. I remember when we did this first UNDP report, now almost 10 years ago, I put the ecosystem as a core concept, and it was slap because everybody said, nobody will get what you're talking about. They will think about the environment, and let's not make it too complicated. 10 years later, it's used by everyone very naturally and seems to be something that really makes sense to people as a business approach. I didn't get a sense that people had still these question marks of what ecosystem is he talking about? Why are we talking about systems at all? This is a huge progression, I find. And very encouraging, because I think that's the way to really move ahead, to think about systems rather than business models and individual solutions.
And related to the comments that the Indian Minister of Commerce was making this morning about the laws of nature, do you get a sense that not just ecosystem, but kind of thinking around how nature solves problems is kind of starting to infiltrate the way we problem solve as people?
Mm-hmm. I liked his, what did he say? That our so-called knowledge replaced the wisdom of our ancestors. Yeah, I think that's something that's also dawning on everyone now, that It's not just brain, it's also heart.
Yeah. Christina, thank you so much for joining me.
I find that very moving.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, change hackers.